Very good. All right. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahanau Bhunaktu, Saha Virjam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavadhi Tamastuma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi. Om. Very good. Today is an especially exciting moment in our class. Believe it or not, a Swami can get excited. Starting the 13th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, for me, honestly, is very exciting. I've taught the Bhagavad Gita through several times, but each time we come to this point, it's exciting. And it's exciting because it's a very dramatic and important shift of attention and inquiry. Really speaking, it's like beginning a whole new text. When you compare the subject matter of the last few chapters to the subject matter of what begins in chapter 13 and continues for the remainder of the Bhagavad Gita, you'll find that they're utterly different. Not little different. Very, very different. Why is that so? Well, if you put it in context, Sri Krishna giving this very important discourse to Arjuna on a battlefield, there are different things to be taught, different aspects of the teaching. And that's true in any kind of teaching situation. There are transitional points. The subject matter is big. A big subject matter is certainly going to be broken up into smaller parts or units. Think about your college days. Whatever you learned was broken up into so many courses. Each of your courses probably had further subdivisions. You studied one thing for a few months, you studied something else for a few months. So it wouldn't be surprising if we find the Bhagavad Gita is also broken up into several parts. Let us talk about those parts first, just to get some orientation, and then we'll turn our attention to chapter 13. A very fundamental division that occurs in the Bhagavad Gita, many of you have seen this because we've talked about this before, but if you haven't, this division, threefold division of the Bhagavad Gita, is absolutely essential to understand the flow of the text. If you don't get the big picture, it's as though you're wading through 700 verses. Well, you can pretty easily lose your way in 700 verses. Fortunately, they're broken up into 18 chapters. But to help us get organized, we can find that those 18 chapters are in three groups of six. We've just concluded the middle six chapters. We're just about to begin the final six chapters. That's why it's an important transition. And just to remind you, the main content of these middle six chapters is bhakti, devotion. In chapters, just a quick review, in chapters 7 and 9, we discussed who is Bhagavan. Who is Ishvara, God of the universe? Who? If we're praying, who are we praying to? 7 and 9 are about that. Chapter 10, Vibhuti Yoga, talking about God's glories. And that takes a little transition. Chapters 7 and 9 are very, what's the word? Very detailed oriented, very much full of jnanam, knowledge. Who? And then in chapter 10, a transition is taken. Talking about Bhagavan's glories, it becomes a little bit more emotional. And in chapter 11 is Sri Krishna revealing his cosmic form. And that's a dramatic high point of the whole Bhagavad Gita. Arguably, it's a dramatic high point of the entire Mahabharata. Sri Krishna, revealing his cosmic form. And we've just concluded chapter 12, giving extremely important concluding teachings about bhakti. So, chapter 8, we said, was that little detour, talked about death primarily. But with that exception, middle six chapters talk about bhakti. In the first six chapters, there were several subject matters, but one subject matter predominated. And that subject matter is karma yoga. Karma yoga comes first in chapter 2, in spite of chapter 2 being primarily about jnanam, sankhya yoga it's called, in spite of it being primarily about fundamental spiritual knowledge, the topic of karma yoga is one of many topics that come in chapter 2. Chapter 3 is called karma yoga. Chapters 4 and 5 also talk about karma yoga. So we could say that karma yoga, is the primary subject matter of the first. Not the only subject matter, but the primary subject matter. Now we come to the last of the six chapters. Here, we're going to find a lot of detailed analysis. Analysis of ourselves, analysis of our three gunas, our personality traits, analysis of our personalities. There's a lot of that you'll find here. A lot of reflection on who we are, and chapter 13 begins with one of the most profound inquiries into understanding who we are, distinguishing the truth of ourselves, finding out what is the essence. So we could say in general that the final six chapters are devoted to jnanam, the word we use for spiritual knowledge. So karma, bhakti, and jnana, spirituality while engaged in activities, devotion to God, and spiritual knowledge. These form the three parts in general. When you look at traditional commentaries, you'll often find a different division. This is a very popular analysis in terms of karma, bhakti, and jnana. But a very traditional analysis is to look at the first six chapters as primarily talking about you, the individual jiva. And in chapter 2, it talks about the nature of the self, atma. Talks about the nature of the soul, the sukshma sharira, which travels. Chapters 3, 4, and 5 are all about karma yoga, a spiritual practice. Spiritual practices are meant for whom? Jiva. Jiva means the individual person, individual being. And chapter 6 is on dhyana, meditation. Again, for the sake of the jiva. So we can look in this other analysis, we can see the first six chapters primarily treating the jiva, the individual being. The middle six chapters turn their attention to Ishvara, Lord, God. That was pretty obvious. As we just said, bhakti, bhakti leads us to Ishvara. That's what it's all about. And then, with this analysis, now how to characterize these last six chapters. Well, a conventional way of looking at it is in the Mahavakya, tat tvam asi. Tat means that. Tvam means you. Asi, the verb, are. You are that. And it's a declaration of the fact that the consciousness which is within you, the consciousness which is the divinity within you, that consciousness is nothing but Ishvara, the God of the cosmos. And we'll talk much more about that. But in that Mahavakya, Tat Tvamasi, the surface meaning of Tvam is you, Jiva. The surface meaning, and I have to say these awkward expressions like surface meanings, because the study of that one Mahavakya, three words, you can spend months and months going into that Vakya. So that's why I have to say surface meaning. The simple meaning of Jiva is Tvam. Simple meaning of Ishvara is Tat. And with that in mind, you can figure out what we're going to put in this circle. Right. The teachings which reveal the identity or the connection between the individual and the whole, the identity of the divinity within and the divinity without. So this is what we're entering into. Pretty important subject matter. Of course, you couldn't possibly look at the Bhagavad Gita and say, well, this part is important and this part is unimportant. There are no unimportant parts. But you can see the significance of this boundary we've reached. So for the time being, our discussion about Ishvara and our relationship to Ishvara in bhakti and devotion is set aside. And we're going to turn now in a very profound way to this spiritual knowledge, jnana, where we recognize this identity and it's pure Vedanta. And what do we mean by pure Vedanta, and why are we studying it here in the 13th chapter? We'll speak of in a few minutes. Why don't we begin? We'll chant the opening verses of chapter 13, and then we'll proceed with an overview of the chapter. The title of the chapter: Kshetra Kshetrajna Yoga. And it means the distinction between the kshetra, the world of experience, and the kshetrajna, you, the experiencer. That's the title of the chapter. We'll have much, much more to say about kshetra and kshetrajna in just a few minutes. Let's begin with some chanting. Repeat after me, please. Arjuna Vacha, Arjuna. Prakritim purusham chaiva prakritim kshetram kshetrajnam eva cha kshetram kshetram etad veditum ichhami etad ve jnanam jneyam cha keshava jnanam jneyam shri bhagavanu vacha Hiram shariram kaunteya, hiram shariram. Kshetramitya vidhiyate, kshetramitya vidhiyate. Etad yo vetitam prahuhu, etad yo. Kshetragnya hiti tadviraha, kshetragnya hiti tadviraha. Kshetragnyam chapi mam vidhi, kshetragnyam chapi mam. Sarva kshetreshu bharata, sarva kshetra. Kshetragnya yor jnanam, kshetragnya yor. Yattad jnanam matam mama, yattad jnanam. Tat kshetram yatcha yadrikcha, tat kshetram yatcha. Tad vikari yatascha yat, yad vikari yata. Sacha yo yat prabhavascha, sacha yo. Tat samasenam eshrinu, tat samasenam eshrinu. Rishibhir bahudha gitam, rishibhir bahudha. Chando bhir vividaih pratak, chando bhir vividaih. Brahma sutra padaish chayva, brahma sutra padaish. Hetu madhir vinishchitaihi, hetu madhir vinishchitaihi, mahabhutanya hankaro, mahabhutanya. Buddhiravyaktam evacha, buddhiravyaktam. Indriyani dashaikam cha, indriyani dashaikam. Pancha chendriya gochara, pancha chendriya gochara, itcha dvesha sukham dukham, itcha dvesha sukham dukham. Sanghatas chetana dhritihi sanghatas etat kshetram samasena etat kshetram savikaram udahritam savikaram amanitvam adambhitvam amanitvam ahimsa kshantirajavam ahimsa Acharyopasanam shaucham, Acharyopasanam shaucham. Sthairyamatma vinigraha, Sthairyamatma vinigraha. Indriyarteshu vairagyam, Indriyarteshu Anahankara hevacha, Anahankara Janma mrityuchara vyadhi, janma mrityuchara dhukadoshanudarshanam, dhukadoshanudarshanam asaktiranabhishvangaha, asaktiranabhishvangaha putradara grahadishu, putradara nityamcha samachittatvam, nityamcha samachittatvam Ishtanishtopapattishu, Ishtanishtopapattishu. Good. There we have the opening chapters, the opening 10 verses of the Bhagavad Gita. We're going to recite the English version in just a moment. And just to introduce that, traditionally, people chanting, students chanting the Bhagavad Gita would have had an opportunity to study Sanskrit sufficiently that the meaning is clear as you're chanting. Now, it takes quite a bit. The Sanskrit of the Bhagavad Gita is fairly simple, but Sanskrit is not simple. And it took, for me, it was at least 10 years of study before I could chant the Bhagavad Gita and get the full meaning as I'm chanting. We've just chanted the first 10 verses. It's likely that very few of you have had an opportunity to study Sanskrit sufficiently to get the full meaning. But it's really important to chant and get the meaning, which is why we have this English version. Most of you are familiar? It has the same meter as the original. It's slightly condensed, so it's very easy to understand and follow. First verse, you can listen and repeat, and then we'll recite together. Arjuna said, I want to understand these all. I want to understand what is nature and consciousness. What is nature? What is the field who knows of it? What is the field who knows? What is knowledge? How is it known? What is knowledge? Chant together, do the best you can. The Blessed Lord said, Arjuna, recognize the field, as the body has all that's known. One who perceives the field is called the knower, witness, consciousness. Of each field the knower am I. Within all fields I there abide. About the knower and the field, hear briefly what I have to say. The field includes all elements, space, air, fire, water and earth. Also your body, mind and heart, senses and everything perceived, freedom from pretension and pride, patience, harmlessness, rectitude, toward all your teachers, reverence, purity, firmness, self-restraint, dispassion toward desired things, freedom from ego, I and mine, attention to the problems of life, birth, death, old age, disease and pain, absence of all attachments for children, wife, home and all the rest, persistent equanimity toward enjoyment and suffering, steady devotion unto me with single-minded vigilance, contentment in secluded sites, freedom from craving company, commitment to Vedantic study, and for discovering the truth, to gain knowledge, these are the means. All else leads but to ignorance. What you should know, I shall now state, through which you can overcome death. Brahman, eternal and supreme, beyond being and nothingness, outside and inside of all things, sentient and insentient, much too subtle to be conceived, so remote yet abiding here, undivided yet in all things, as though divided, thus it seems, sustainer of all that exists, creator and destroyer too, it is the light of every light, shining beyond dark ignorance, it is the knowledge to be abiding in the hearts of all, as to nature and consciousness, know that both are meaning, beginningless, all that changes, all qualities arise from nature, know this well, action, power, and agency, from nature these all emanate, but your feelings, pleasure and pain, all arise due to consciousness. Consciousness in nature abides, sensing whatever happens there. This the witness perceiving all is the embodied Self Supreme. Whatever beings may be known, animate or inanimate, come from the union of the field with the knower, with consciousness, knowing the Lord who dwells within the hearts of all identically, remaining when they cease to be. Those who see this, they truly see all actions done in every way take place due to nature alone. The conscious self remains detached. Those who see this, they truly see, just as space immaterial pervades all yet is undisturbed, so too the self remains untouched, though pervading the body's form, just as the earth entirely is illumined by but one sun, so too all matter everywhere is revealed by one consciousness. There you have an overview, and here, at least reciting in English, you get some idea of what our subject matter is coming up, and perhaps you got the sense that it's a pretty challenging subject matter. It is. Arguably, chapter 13 could be called the most philosophical of the 18 chapters of the Bhagavad Gita. Now, whenever I say that word, I'm smiling now because to me and to my teacher and to my tradition, to call something philosophical is a great insult. Huh? To call a spiritual teaching philosophical indeed is an insult. Yet you'll find that this... I won't call this chapter philosophical. Many people do. And to me, that's an insult. Why is it an insult? When we look at the subject matter, sure looks philosophical. You're talking about the word field that came at the beginning, field of experience, and the knower. Who is the knower? What is a field of experience? How do you know what you know? How do you experience the world around you? How do you experience your own thoughts? And what is a connection between that experiencer, or better yet, that witness consciousness? What is the connection between that witness consciousness and your feelings and thoughts and emotions? What is the connection between that witness consciousness and the universe? What is the connection between that witness consciousness and God? These are heavy, heavy questions. And this is what leads this chapter to be too often seen as philosophical. Now, why is philosophical, in my opinion, an insult? Remember, we've had this discussion certainly when we began our study of the Bhagavad Gita, but perhaps not since. So let us return to that very important discussion. Few of you will remember in that discussion I made that very odd statement. In the first Bhagavad Gita class, I sat here and declared, if you're coming here to study Bhagavad Gita, you're wasting your time. That's how we began our study. And I went on to explain then that the Bhagavad Gita is not meant for academic study. And what we're engaged in here is certainly not a process of academic study. So in that sense, the academic study of Bhagavad Gita, in my opinion, truly is wasting our time. If you're in a religious studies department in a university, then it has value, because then you can get a good grade, you can graduate. Although if you graduate with a religious studies degree, I'm not sure what you do with that. Presumably it has some value. Now, when we say philosophical, please remember the meaning. Philosophy, of course, are Greek, from Greek words, philio, meaning love, and Sophia was the name of the goddess of knowledge, and I guess it represents knowledge. I'm not much of an expert on Greek, but I know that the word philosophy then means love of knowledge. A philosopher is someone who loves knowledge. You can imagine their bookshelf doesn't just have 3 volumes on it. Probably a professional philosopher will have bookshelves crammed with books and have a mind crammed with knowledge. Now, that philosopher, having dedicated himself or herself to acquiring knowledge because they love knowledge more than anything, having acquired all of that knowledge, do you think that philosopher is any happier today than they were before they acquired all that philosophical knowledge? Or do you think that they're more or less the same? Probably the same. Because all of that knowledge, just acquiring knowledge, doesn't change you. Think of how much knowledge you've acquired. You go through all your schooling, all your education, but you emerge, you're more mature. Let's create a scenario. Suppose you go in your profession. Suppose there's some continuing education, some professional development course. They put these nice names on. And you attend this professional development course, and it empowers you with some important skills. It can make you better at your work, etc. Good. Does it make you happier? Now, you've acquired a lot of knowledge in that class. Do we emerge from that class happier or unchanged? Of course, if that course helps you get a raise and you get more money, the money may make you happier. But the point I'm making is that the mere acquisition of knowledge doesn't improve the quality of our lives. A philosopher, if we understand a philosopher in a very strict sense, as someone who acquires knowledge, someone who seeks knowledge for its own sake, that's their goal, is to get as much knowledge as they can, we can ask my favorite question we can raise, and that is, well, so what? So you gain a lot of scholarship. So you become academically very knowledgeable. You become a great pundit. You gain great panditya. There is a common image in India of the great pundit comes walking into the room, and all the students suddenly, they get very quiet, real quiet. Why? Panditji is here. They're afraid of this great scholar. Why? After decades of study and teaching and lecturing, this pundit has acquired a great reputation not for what he knows, but a great reputation for being really a disagreeable and difficult person. This happens not infrequently, that someone who lives a life so narrowly dedicated to studies and teaching, perhaps, that they might end up being a little grouchy. Tell me, if you spent your whole life reading these dull, boring philosophy books, wouldn't you get a little grouchy after a while? That's their life. Not necessarily very fulfilling. So, this is a stereotypical image, the great pundit is not one who's necessarily happy, content. Someone who doesn't necessarily have, can we call it spiritual wisdom? If we define spiritual wisdom as that which leads you to contentment, peace, happiness, joy. And here is the distinction between a philosopher and a true student of Bhagavad Gita. Not the academic student of Bhagavad Gita, but a true student of Bhagavad Gita. Both can study the Bhagavad Gita. The philosopher will go through the chapters and learn all of the concepts and ideas therein. So here, in the first verse, that scholar is going to write down Purusha, Prakriti, and start defining these terms. Going to write down Kshetra, Kshetrajna. Start defining these terms. Start writing down Jnanam, Jnayam. What are these terms? Prakriti, what did I miss? That's it. Yeah, there's three pairs. And it turns out that this chapter is pretty much about those three pairs of words. Purusha and Prakriti. Purusha is the cosmic being, truth. Prakriti, nature. Kshetram and Kshetrajnam, we talked about Kshetra, field of experience, Kshetrajna, the knower of the field of experience, and the last one, Jnanam and Jnayam, the last pair, Jnanam, knowledge, Jnayam, that which is to be known, sought through knowledge. Sounds very philosophical. Well, the philosopher is definitely going to take a lot of notes and start doing deep inquiry into the meaning of these three words, three pairs of words, and as they read and study the chapter, they're going to learn a lot about these three pairs of words. By the time they reach the end of the chapter, they are going to be an expert in these three pairs of words. And again, we have to ask the question, so what? The distinction then is that the student of Gita, the spiritual student of Bhagavad Gita, is not reading or studying the Bhagavad Gita for the sake of finding out about these three pairs of words. That's not our orientation. The goal of the philosopher is to acquire knowledge. The goal of a sadhaka, a spiritual seeker, is not to acquire anything. The goal of the sadhaka is to become free from suffering. That's what this is about. That's what Vedanta is about. Do you think the philosopher is really seeking freedom from suffering? That's generally not their orientation. They seek knowledge. But our pursuit, as we study the Bhagavad Gita, as we meditate, as we pray, as we engage in other kinds of spiritual study, all of it really and truly is not an attempt to get anything, not even to reach anything. It's to get rid of something. What is it you get rid of? Well, you can describe it in many ways. The most powerful or clear way is to say to get rid of the source of suffering. Of course, there's a lot there. Suffering comes about when we find ourselves limited, when we find ourselves isolated, inadequate, when we find ourselves separate. So one of the things we get rid of is that sense of isolation, inadequacy, even the sense of separation from Ishvara, separation from God. So this idea of getting rid, and we'll be seeing much more of that as we proceed. We're not getting anything. We're getting rid, I guess in the most general sense, we're getting rid of ignorance, but kinds of ignorance that make us suffer. Ignorance, which is the root of suffering. So how different then is our pursuit? The philosopher pursues knowledge. We pursue freedom from suffering. Now, turns out that our orientation as we study is all important. You've all heard the expression, you see what you're looking for. Isn't it true? You see what you're looking for. If you're reading a book, you're going to get out of that book what you're looking for. So if you're a philosopher, you're looking for knowledge, and in chapter 13 you'll find plenty. But if you're a sadhaka, a spiritual seeker, you will study chapter 13, and what you will get out of it is tremendous guidance and spiritual wisdom to help you come out of worldly suffering. And before we proceed, let's bear in mind that to become free of worldly suffering is not just for your sake. We've observed this many times, and that is whenever you suffer, you have a way of making those around you suffer. So therefore, this teaching blesses us all. And it is so essentially important. That's why we meet here every Saturday morning. That's why I've gone on, should mention briefly, that the reason I go on teaching the Bhagavad Gita over and over again is I keep getting benefited. Every time I teach the Bhagavad Gita, I see more, I grow more. So it blesses us all. It's worth studying again and again and again. We need that much support. All right. So with this introduction, knowing that chapter 13 through 18 talking about jnanam, but now let us not translate jnanam as philosophy. You'll find many people who do. Not for us. So jnanam to us means spiritual wisdom that can lead to the end of suffering. So we begin that now with verse 1. This is actually verse 0. Huh? I'll explain it in just a moment. Repeat after me. Arjuna uvacha prakritam purusham chaiva kshetram kshetrajnam eva cha kshetram etad veditum icchami jnanam jnayam cha keshava. I said this was verse 0 because it's really not part of the Bhagavad Gita. It's not there. If you remember the Bhagavad Gita is a small 700 verse segment from the Mahabharata. If you read those 700 verses from start to end, this verse doesn't occur. Yet, this verse is inserted in most books, not all. Many books won't do that. My traditional commentary, and this is a book just with the verses and Sri Shankaracharya's commentary, not there. And the reason it's not there is if you're scholarly enough to read a book like this, you're supposed to know this verse. This verse is not part of the Bhagavad Gita. It's been inserted here at this position for a very good reason. Obviously not arbitrarily. The next verse, Sri Krishna begins teaching. And the whole of the chapter is spent talking about these three pairs of words. Purusha, Prakriti, Kshetra, Kshetrajna, Jnanam, Jnayam. These three pairs of words. And since the whole chapter seems to be an answer to a question about these three pairs of words, it's possible that the question was there but didn't make it into the text. Now, here, remember the context. On the battlefield, Sri Krishna giving this discourse to Arjuna. Arjuna is going to ask questions from time to time. Most of Arjuna's questions are put in the form of verses in the text. It is presumed that this was a question Arjuna had with regard to these three pairs of words, but for whatever reason, the question wasn't included in the final text. The answer was there, but the question was just omitted. So, this verse is a traditional verse composed by some scholar thousands of years ago. We don't know when. Certainly more than the Bhagavad Gita is at least 2,000 years old. So how old is this verse? At least 2,000 years. So some scholar wrote this verse, composed this verse, to introduce what probably was Arjuna's question. So let's see what is Arjuna's question. Arjuna Uvacha, he said, look at the second line. Etad Veditam Ichami. Etat, this. Veditum, to know. Ichami, I want. Ichami, I want. Veditum, to know. I want to know. I want to know what? Etat, this. Well, what is this that you want to know, Arjuna? He says, Prakritam Purusham Cha Eva. I want to know, what is Prakriti? What is Purusha? If you want a one-word definition, Prakriti means nature. If you want a one-word definition, Purusha, I don't think there is a single word in English that means the same as Purusha in this context. This is not Hindi, please. I'm not talking about Ek Purush, Ek Admi. That's not our context at all. Here, Purusha refers to, if we can use any kind of expression, the cosmic person, so to speak. If you want, you can think of that expression. Prakriti, nature. Purusha, the cosmic being. Not person, cosmic being. Also, kshetram and kshetrajnam evacha. He says, what is kshetra? Field of experience. And kshetrajna, the knower of the field of experience, the witness of everything you experience. Kshetra simply means field, but this is not a farming text. We're not talking about farming. So here, kshetra, field in what sense? Field of experience. Whatever you experience, which includes all that you see, hear, taste, touch, and smell, that's what's outside, but there's so much more inside, all of your thoughts, all of your emotions, all kinds of meditative states, all of that too is part of the kshetra field of experience. So Arjuna wants to know, etad veditum ichami, this I want to know. What do I want to know? What does Arjuna want to know? What is prakriti and purusha? What is nature and the cosmic being? What is kshetram and kshetrajnam? What is the field of experience, and who is the knower of all that we experience? And the last part of the question, jnanam, jnayam, cha. What is jnanam, knowledge, and what is jnayam? Jnayam is that which is to be achieved through knowledge. Jnanam is the means, jnayam is the end, the goal. So Keshava, O Krishna, Arjuna addresses Sri Krishna here, O Keshava, O Krishna, etad veditum ichami, this I want to know. So this verse then introduces these three pairs of questions. Why three pairs of questions? Because there are three pairs of answers in the chapter. And that's what we're going to see. We'll begin in just a moment. And the first one, the first pair that's taken up is Kshetra and Kshetrajna. If you have a very traditional text, you'll find, not a traditional text, if you have a very scholarly text, this is verse 1. Where it begins Sri Bhagavan Uvacha. And some of you may have a text that shows this is verse 1. Those are actually more scholarly. Repeat after me, please. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha, Sri Bhagavan Uvacha. Idam Shariram Kaunteya, Idam Shariram Kaunteya. Kshetramitya Vidhiyate, Kshetram. Etad yo veti tam prahuhu, kshetrajnam hiti tadvidah. Let's see what we want to include and not include today. Good. Sri Bhagavan, the Blessed Lord, Uvacha, he said, Idam shariram kaunteya. Kaunteya, O Arjuna, O son of Kunti. Idam shariram, this body. Idam shariram, kshetram, is the kshetra, field of experience. This body is the field or locus of experience. Iti, thus, abhidhiyate. It is said, it is defined. So, abhidhiyate, this is defined. This body is defined as being the kshetra, the field of experience, the locus of experience. We'll just get the words right now. And yo veti etat, yaha, one who veti knows, one who knows etat, this body. One who knows this body, one who knows this field or locus of experience, tam prahuhu, tam, that person, prahuhu, is called what? Kshetrajnaha. That nya ending means knower. So if someone knows a lot, they are a sarvajna, not a lot, someone who knows everything. Do you know anyone like that? A know in English, know-it-all. In Sanskrit, sarvajna. Of course, they're really not. And sarva-all-nya, knower, sarvajna, knower of all, is a word we use for Ishvara, for God. Sarvajna. And if sarvajna means knowing all, then here we have an alpajna. Alpa means very little. Sarvajna is God, Alpajna is us. Here, Kshetrajna is one who knows Kshetra, one who knows this locus of experience. I know that's a complicated expression, we'll talk about it in just a minute. Iti, thus, Tadviduhu, thus they know, Tadviduhu, they know, thus they know. Who knows? People who know what's going on. People who are wise. So, here, you can imagine that in the absence of that first verse, you wonder, where does this verse come from? Remember, in end of chapter 12, Sri Krishna was talking about bhakti. And now suddenly, can you imagine if you finish chapter 12 and you come to this verse, and Sri Krishna begins teaching, hey Arjuna, this body is the kshetram, the knower of the body is the kshetrajna. Doesn't it seem a little out of context when you're talking about bhakti in the prior verse? That's why this verse zero, sort of so-called verse zero, is inserted. It makes a transition. Now, what is this stuff we're talking about? What is this field of experience? And what is the knower of the field of experience? And most importantly, why should we care? Because on the surface, this does seem very philosophical, on the surface. the broader topic that's introduced with this verse is Atma Anatma Viveka. This is a very important expression. Let me explain it. Atma simply means self. Obviously, self in a very fundamental sense we'll talk about. Anatma, obviously, not self. Viveka means discrimination. And discrimination, you know, in English we use that word discriminate in different senses. You know, to discriminate against a certain category of people is not what we're talking about here. This discrimination means to discriminate A from B, to distinguish one thing from another. Viveka is almost always translated as discrimination, but in this sense, the ability to discriminate or discern. This is this, that is that. What is the difference? Now, this very important expression is one of the fundamental teachings of Vedanta, to distinguish between self and not self. Or simply put, to distinguish between you and everything else. Now, to a person who's not spiritually inclined or not philosophically inclined, this question sounds ridiculous. Basically, it's the inquiry, you know, who am I? And what is that, what is not I? What is everything else? That question, who am I? Remember I told you this story long ago? I was visiting my mother, reading one of Puja Swami Dayananda's books, and the title of the book is Who Am I? And she says, what are you reading? I show her the book. She reads it. Who am I? She says, don't you know who you are? My mother explained. She says, I can tell you who you are. You're my son. It was so obvious to her. Well, clearly these questions can be read on different levels. This is meant at a very profound level. Atma Anatma Viveka, to distinguish between that which you are and that which you aren't. Now, before we actually look at the teaching, why? Why would something that's so apparently philosophical, note the words, something that so much is apparently philosophical, how should that be helpful to us in gaining freedom from suffering, which is what our orientation is? Let's talk about this. Suppose you're a pet lover. You like dogs or cats. You have a pet at home. If a stranger's cat gets run over, does it affect you? Maybe a little. Actually, maybe that's not a good example. Because, you know, someone who really loves cats, oh no! Poor kitty! drop it. Let me better go for another example. I think last time I taught this, I think I used cars as an example. You're driving down the road. Somebody's car is on the side of the road. They just had an accident. You go by and think, and you keep going. Now, you're not particularly upset that this fellow had an accident. You know it happens, especially this Route 1. What a dangerous road. Really dangerous road. You go on that road, you take your life literally in your hands. You don't know when some kooky person is going to come. By the way, no joke, as some of you may have heard, there was a New Jersey policeman who just died in an accident on Route 1. So please do be careful. So you're driving along Route 1. You see somebody else's car in an accident. You don't think too much of it. Suppose it's your car. Suppose your car gets dented. So not a small thing, right? Then it's a big thing. How much we respond to a car getting dented, sometimes our response is totally inappropriate. And I pardon me for telling this story again, but it's a favorite story. It's the story of my first new car. Some of you remember this? I was living in California. This is in the, I think, early 1980s. Yeah. I know the date because I bought my first brand new car, a 1981 Honda Civic. And the Civics then were very simple cars. You know, today they're nicer, but it was the most basic car you could imagine at those times. And living in Los Angeles, and the story I'm going to tell you is exactly as it took place. I bought the car, drove the car out of the lot for the first time. It felt so good. I was living in the San Fernando Valley of California, if any of you know that area. I bought it from a car dealership there. I pull out onto the main road, and I come up to a stoplight. I'm waiting for it to turn green. As I'm waiting for the light to turn, there's a car behind me, and I look through the rearview mirror, and they come rolling up a little bit too fast, and then bang! I had been out of the dealer's lot for less than 1 minute. And then I'm shocked. I'm in a state of shock. I look up in the rear of a mirror, and as I'm watching, I see this car back off and then start rolling forward again, and bang, a second time. This is exactly as it took place. By then, you know, I'm a angry young man. I get out of the car. I walk over there. What's going on? I'm so angry. And inside the car, this very nice young, I think she was a Korean woman. And she apparently didn't really know English. She couldn't explain to me what had happened. But she was kind of like apologizing and all this and pointing down. What is she pointing at? She's pointing at the stick shift. She didn't know how to drive this manual transmission. And that's how it is. You can imagine if you don't know what you're doing to kind of have that problem at a stoplight. You can imagine the first time you drove stick shift, it could have been you. First time I drove stick shift, it could have been me. All right, it happens. So I came to understand what went wrong. The point of the story is how irate I was. The car wasn't even, there was a small dent. It wasn't even a big deal. Was my reaction, the reaction of that angry young man, was my reaction proportional to what happened? Certainly not. Now, you'd have to admit that's a pretty ordinary kind of experience. We all tend to react, sometimes more, sometimes less. What is it that makes us react? When it's somebody else's car that gets dented, it's who cares? If it's my car, it's a very big deal. My car. I can still remember my own guru's teaching about this. He says, my car. He says, if it's your car, my. He asks this very interesting question. Where is the my-ness of your car? This is what Pujaswami Dayananda likes to teach. He's very analytical like this. Where is the my-ness located? You say it's my car. Obviously, the car that's on the side of the road is not my car. There's no my-ness associated with that car. Minus is associated with this 1981 Honda Civic. So Pujaswami Dayananda asks the question, fine, where is the minus exactly? Is the minus in the nice nice fake leather interior. Is that where the minus is? Is the minus in this powerful engine? Is the minus in the nice stereo? He asks the question, where is the minus located? And he asks that question to make us think twice. Because really speaking, it's just a car. And that car having a little dent, it's trivial. You'd all agree? A car with even a brand new car, fine. But it's a little dent. So it shouldn't make a big deal. It made a big deal why there was minus, I'm going to be just totally silly here, there was a lot of minus in the bumper. And when that bumper got this little dent, it's like I was dented. In some more philosophical language or more spiritual language, we could say, I was identified with the car. In other words, to when I say I am identified with the car, it means that my sense of who I am somehow gets projected projected. It gets projected into the car. Of course, there's no I-ness in the car. I am me, nothing happened to me, but we project something that's not there. Adhyasa is the Sanskrit word for projection. Sometimes we do this adhyasa very deliberately. It's fun. When I'm teaching children to teach them about symbolism, I ask them, this is cute, you'll enjoy this. And if you teach children, this is a nice way to teach them about symbolism, how symbolism works. I ask kids, is a piece of cloth anything special that we should regard with reverence? And kids say, no, it's just a piece of cloth. And then I ask the kids, well, suppose that piece of cloth is a big rectangle. Suppose that piece of cloth has a big stripe of orange across the top, has a big stripe of white in the middle, has a big stripe of green at the bottom, and has this big circle thing. Looks like a wheel with spokes in it, in the middle. I ask the kids, is this just an ordinary piece of cloth? And the kids say, no. You know, they all understand that's India's flag, which means that's a piece of cloth that you treat with respect. Now, please tell me, in that flag, where is India located? Is India in the orange part, or in the white part, in the green part, or in the chakra? India is not in the flag except in our minds, in our hearts. We deliberately project a great country onto our national flags, all flags. And having done so, because we have some pride in our country, Deshbhakt. Because you're a Deshbhakt, because you have pride in your country, therefore that pride gets transferred on to the flag. Of course, if that flag is burnt, as Indian flags are sometimes burnt, we know about that in Pakistan, etc. So when that Indian flag is burnt in some protest in Pakistan or elsewhere, does that really affect the country? Not at all. It affects our hearts. It doesn't affect the country. Well, this is projection. This is identification. We project the country onto the flag. By the way, if you're teaching children, what a nice way to teach them. You say, just as we project the country onto the flag, we project God onto the deities on the altars. You can use this kind of thing for teaching children. So let's come back and finish up our introduction for today. If somebody is overly protective of a flag, in my opinion, it's misdirected concern. One thing I love about this country is that there's no law against burning flags.
There's no law.
I think, and every now and then, somebody will say, oh, we have to pass a law, outlawing the desecration of flags. I think it's wonderful that this country allows it, because this country is strong enough to know if somebody wants to burn a flag, let them. It's free speech. If they want to burn a dozen flags, who cares? The country is strong in spite of that. But if we have a more limited understanding and say, oh no, no, that'll hurt us, that'll hurt the country, it doesn't. It's wrong thinking. This country is strong enough that we need not care about someone burning a flag. Now, we're running out of time, so we're going to have to return to this topic tomorrow. But here's the point, that we're going to return to this in a big way. Whatever you're identified with, you take too seriously. If you think that flag is the country embodied, it's too serious. Lighten up. It's going to get burnt now and then, and the country is going to be okay. But in the same way, when I, as a young man, projected my myness, pardon the bad language, when I projected my myness onto the bumper of this 1981 Honda Civic, it's ridiculous. It's just a bumper. Why should I make such a big thing of it? Whatever you project yourself onto, you take it too seriously, it becomes a source of suffering. If I project onto the bumper of my car, it becomes a source of suffering. If I project onto the interior of the car, then when it's dirty and ripped, it becomes a source of suffering. When you identify with your car becomes a source of suffering. When you identify with your home becomes a source of suffering. If somebody else's home has peeling paint, is it a big deal? If your home has peeling paint, it might be a big deal. So if you identify with your home becomes a source of suffering. If you identify with your children become a source of suffering. If you identify with your body becomes a source of suffering. If you identify with your thoughts and emotions, we're going to talk a lot about this, but just to show you where we're going. If you identify with your thoughts and emotions, your thoughts and emotions become a source of suffering. This all has to be explained in great detail, and we will in our next class. But this is the value of Atma Anatma Viveka. It's to know that I am okay even if the car gets dented, because the car is anatma, it's not me. The country is okay if the flag gets burnt. I am okay if the bumper gets dented. I am okay if the house has peeling paint, or God forbid it burns down. I am okay. You are okay. If the children are having some difficult times, I don't have any. You are okay. We are okay if there's a problem in the body. Now, to discover that means you have to know that the body is not me. What happens to the body doesn't happen to me. This is Atma Anatma Viveka. To know that what happens to the body doesn't happen to me. To know that I am okay regardless. In spite of the condition of the body, I am okay. This is Atma Anatma Viveka. Now you can begin to see the value of this, the importance of this, and why it's such a fundamental teaching in Vedanta. So, the second verse. Actually, it's the first verse, right? It's the first verse of the chapter, really speaking. And in that very first verse, this is our subject matter. And when we meet next week, we'll continue. All right. A couple of quick announcements. In the next week or two, you'll be receiving our new newsletter. On a newsletter, we have a lot of new programs, or resuming programs that we